The theme music from a movie based on an Agatha Christie novel that featured Hercule Poirot. And I think it's a good piece of music to get us started on today's show. I'm sure we'll be talking a bit about Agatha Christie, maybe a little about Hercule Poirot, and probably many, many more as we talk about mystery books that feature gardens and gardening. Our guest for this next hour is Marta McDowell. She teaches landscape history and horticulture at the New York Botanical Garden, a very popular lecturer and writer. Her books, and I'm going to give you a list of some of her books, is just a great list. Unearthing the Secret Garden is one. Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life. Another, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. A New York Times best-selling book titled All the President's Gardens. And Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life, which is now in its ninth printing. She was the 2019 recipient of the Garden Club of America's Sarah Chapman Francis Medal for Outstanding Literary Achievement. And we're going to talk with her about her latest book, and it is titled Gardening Can Be Murder, How Poisonous Poppies, Sinister Shovels, and Grim Gardens Have Inspired Mystery Writers. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Love to hear from you. Do you like mysteries but with botanical elements to them? I kind of do. You have questions about one of Marta's other books? Join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Marta McDowell, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure.
I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book. It's fun. It was a lot of fun to read and brought and sort of gave me some new insights into how gardens are used in mysteries, which I hadn't really thought that much about until I read your book. But I'm wondering, just how did you get interested in gardening? I mean, look at the career you've had.
Well, let's see. My great aunt Mary had a wonderful garden at her home. She lived in Atlanta, Illinois. And I think that was the first garden that really struck me. I didn't really have much of a garden until I had a house of my own. So I really started gardening seriously in my 20s and have gardened like that ever since.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, and as I've indicated, you've written a number of books about historical gardens, Emily Dickinson, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Our Presidents. What intrigues you about those gardens?
Well, I guess you can tell, Larry, I like to garden and I like to read. So the whole, looking at gardeners who are also authors or vice versa, really just happened accidentally. This is my second career. I was on a business trip. I was visiting insurance agencies across Massachusetts, and I had a open afternoon, and I just kind of bumped into Emily Dickinson's home in Amherst, Massachusetts, and found out she was a gardener and thought, gee, that would be interesting to write about. It's like, I always say, Emily Dickinson changed my life.
that's a wonderful story. Well, here you are with your new book, Gardening Can Be Murder. Certainly a different course. Where did that idea come from?
Well, actually started quite a while ago. I read a book called Mulch. It's by Ann Ripley, who I don't think she's with us anymore, but she was a Colorado garden writer. And, this was her first mystery, and she made the protagonist, you write about what you know. So she made the protagonist a garden writer. And the plot, sort of revolved around her trying to mulch her garden not having enough leaves because she wanted to use shredded leaves and went out and picked up other people's leaves around the neighborhood. And oops, one of those bags had body parts in it. So, and it just struck me. I thought, gee, I'll bet there are a lot of gardening mysteries. And I've always loved to read mysteries. It's sort of my brain candy. And so it just kind of started there. I started kind of keeping an eye out for them. And then during COVID, I thought, I gotta do something. So I decided that would be the perfect pandemic project.
Well, you know, I visited with a lot of authors over the last year or so, and most of the books were written during COVID, or a good many of them, let's put it that way. And people made pretty good use of their time, and you did as well with this particular book. So how did you go about the research on this? I think you talk a little about it at the beginning.
Yeah, so I had quite a few on my shelves that I had read over the years. Because again, this wasn't a brand new idea. And then I had some friends who were big murder mystery readers. So I asked them. And then as I started doing, you know, during lockdown, I was doing a lot of Zoom talks, which I had never done. I didn't even know what Zoom was.
Yeah.
And I would tell people what I was working on, and I would get out of the blue, someone would send me their list of their favorite gardening murder mysteries. So I had no intention of crowdsourcing this, Larry, but it sort of happened that way.
Oh, Andrea and Madison's been waiting a bit. Let's just get to Andrea. You've got some recommendations, Andrea?
Oh, yes. One of my favorite books in this mystery garden crossover genre is The White Garden, a novel of Virginia Woolf and Sissinghurst, by Stephanie Barron. Have you ever read it?
It's marvelous. I knew Stephanie Barron from her books about Jane Austen. So she also wrote a series with Jane Austen and her sister solving murders. And so I was thrilled to find The White Garden. I have been lucky enough to visit Sissinghurst, and I'm interested in that whole crowd of the Bloomsbury group. So it is a really good read, and you're right. It sort of it touched all of my interests. So it was literary and gardening and historic garden.
The White Garden. Andrea, did you have something else you wanted to recommend?
Yeah, in terms of humor, I've gotten a real kick out of Rhapsody in Green by Charlotte Mendelson. She's a modern essayist, and she's just a hoot. I have her book with tons of little paper markings where she said something very funny.
I love it. Marta, are you familiar with Rhapsody in Green?
I am not, and I've just scribbled it down, so I will certainly pick that one up.
Andrea, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Well, as long as we're on callers here, let's go to Martha in Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hey, Larry. Okay, here's one for you. This is a Chicago writer who was born in River Falls, Wisconsin. So there's a little home state tie-in here. And the book is called The House by the Side of the Road. And this author won an award for her first novel. This is her second novel. But the whole plot and the whole solving of this murder mystery in this book hedges on certain narcissist plantings in the yard. And I don't want to give away any more. but if you read the book, pay attention to the gardener.
And who is the author, Martha?
Her name is Jan Gleiter, and she's out of Chicago.
Oh, Martha?
Okay, that is a new one for me, and I really appreciate that. I'm always on the lookout. I have a growing list, and I've put my whole list is on my website, and I have been adding to it. And this one I wouldn't have picked up from just a, you know, I always look at the shelf of new mysteries in my library every time I go. This week I read one called The Garden Plot. So that one is like, okay, I'll bet that's one for me. But I would not have picked up on this, The House by the Side of the Road. So I will definitely put that on my wish list.
I'll bring one up for you as long as we're at it. John Sanford, great mystery writer. And there was, and now I can't think of the title, but there's a series of John Sanford's where he uses, the protagonist is Virgil Flowers. And Virgil is out to check on a murder. And there was a young woman singer involved, and he couldn't find her. So he went to the father's house. And the guy was out in the garden, working in the garden. And I talked to him, and eventually he finds the daughter, but she's not the killer. And there are several other people that weren't the killers. And then he goes back to the father, and the father, whose wife had left with a lover, supposedly, he gets an idea and he does some testing. And this was out in the country. And it turns out that he is able to determine that there's something under the garden. And under the garden, the guy had killed his wife and lover, and he was a heavy equipment operator too. And he dug a big hole and stuck the car in it with them inside, and then covered it and made a garden on top of it. And it caught me completely by surprise at the end. And so now I've given away the whole thing, but I haven't given away the top title of the book because I can't remember it.
So now it's a scavenger hunt, Larry, not for the murderer, but for the what's the book. I bet somebody will call in with the title.
Somebody will probably call in with the title. Marta McDowell, our guest today, her book is titled Gardening Can Be Murder. Love to hear from you. Have you got a recommended mystery that involves gardens or gardening? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Right now, we're in the murder mystery business as it relates to gardening with our guest, Marta McDowell. Her book, her latest book, Gardening Can Be Murder, How Poisonous Poppies, as this is the subtitle, How Poisonous Poppies, Sinister Shovels, and Grim Gardens Have Inspired Mystery Writers. And by the way, I like how you organized your book. Talk about the various sections of the book that you have.
So, you know, normally if I'm writing a gardening book about an author, let's say, it's pretty easy to organize it because I generally do it with the arc of their life, the way you would do a biography. This one didn't have that, so I had to come up with its own framework, or if you like, a skeleton. I use the kind of classic elements of a murder mystery. So you have to have a detective, you have some sort of setting, you have, of course, that motive, means, opportunity, you have suspects, you have clues, and of course, you have the mystery writer.
Well, and you know, let's take settings, for example. And gardens often, as you point out, act as kind of as stages. They serve as backdrops, do they not, for all kinds of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned one earlier, you know, yes, it can be the place where you bury the body. But it can also be a place where you have a garden party where, you know, different suspects come together. It can be used as, you know, the kind of historical interest. One of your callers mentioned the White Garden and Sissinghurst, but, you know, that's just one example. You can have historic gardens. You can have made up gardens, you know, so. Yeah. Lots of different ways.
One that I was remembering, Mark Mills' book in 2007, The Savage Garden. That's a set in, isn't it, an Italian villa garden? Is there something, by the way, is there something that stands out in an Italian villa garden, as far as you know?
Well, they Italian villa gardens tend to be quite symmetrical. They tend to have rooms, but they also have a lot of symbolism. And I think that's what he used really well in that book, was sort of going through the symbolism of all the statues. Usually there are all sorts of classical statuaries. So he pulled that in, I thought, in a really nice way.
So the mystery, what was the mystery in there? I'm trying to remember, and I don't remember it. It was a murder.
Yeah, it was a murder, and again, it was a sort of complicated family story, and so he picks up some of the mythology from the garden and sort of plays that into the story of how the murder, or why the murder happened.
You know, I was also intrigued for a variety of reasons when you were talking about garden settings, but they can also shift a series out of its usual location, or add some descriptive layers to it. And Jill Nadeau, the executive producer for the show, and myself are both big fans of Louise Penny.
Yes.
And I think both of us have read virtually every one of her mysteries. And you point out a couple of them where the investigator, Armand Gamache, is always in Three Pines. But a couple of times he gets out of Three Pines. In one book, one was The Beautiful Mystery, and I think the other one was Trick of the Light.
Absolutely. So Beautiful Mystery, that was the one where he goes out to the monastery, right? The very remote monastery. And so there is a monastery garden that plays, you know, into that story. And again, I think for an author, especially like think Louise Penny, what she's probably got 20?
More than, 22, I think. Something.
Yeah. 20 plus. So, you know, yes, it's great to, you get used to Three Pines, and we all love Three Pines, but, you know, I'm sure she wants to say, okay, let's try somewhere else.
Yeah. And you don't mind it, but then you're always kind of glad when Armand gets back to Three Pines.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it gives the mystery writer a chance to try something a little different. I mean, in the end, there's somebody gets murdered and Armand Gamache figures it out, but it's a kind of a new way of looking at everything. I think the writing in A Trick of the Light, that is set in Three Pines.
Yes, but there are some really important garden scenes that are in Three Pines. She don't always hear, you know, she doesn't always talk about the gardens in Three Pines, so she pulls up some different aspect.
Yeah, it's she does indeed. Marta McDowell, our guest, maybe you've got a book to share that a mystery that involves gardening. Or a favorite one anyway, or maybe you have a question about it. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Ellie in Madison emailed us to say that the book Back to the Garden by Lori King was absolutely her favorite mystery from the last year. Out of the 24 mystery books that she read, she loved that it was a historical fiction as well as a mystery, and the protagonists were really compelling. So back to the garden. And
yeah, I don't know that one. I like Laurie King. She's written a long series that has a Sherlock Holmes connection. And so I don't know if it's part of that or not, but I'll look that one up as well.
Frank in Springbrook called, couldn't stay with us, but wonders if you are familiar with White, the book White Oleander by Janet Fitch.
Yes, absolutely. So White Oleander, she gives away the means, you know, the murder weapon in the title. Oleander being one of those poisonous plants. And it's a great book. It's not a, you know, a classic murder mystery, but it definitely fits the theme.
Yeah.
Sure. Because it's about death and plants.
Veronica in West Allis emailed to say that the Flavia Deluce series of mysteries, in her mind, is the best. The young protagonist is always using plants to solve the crime or create mischief.
Yes, you bet. So that is by a Canadian author, Alan, whose last name escapes me right at the moment. But the series starts out with Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie. What a great title. And his protagonist starts out, I think she's 11 years old. So he was not going to make the mistake that Agatha Christie made with Miss Marple by starting her out too old. And it's a wonderful series. As your listener wrote, the Flavia is a little naughty. The one I remember is she has an older sister that she has this love-hate relationship with, and she decides she is going to lace her sister's lip gloss with extract of poison ivy.
Oh my goodness. And Jill's letting me know that the author's last name was Bradley.
Oh, thank you. So, he's Canadian. I couldn't come up with it.
So what's his first name? The first name?
Alan Bradley.
Oh, Alan Bradley. Jill says she loves this particular series. Well, bringing that up, reminds me of something you wrote about earlier, which was the Nancy Drew mystery series. And you had a sidebar that I didn't, somehow I never came upon this or didn't realize it. But the Nancy Drew mysteries, the backstory to the series, is that the author's name was made up.
Yes, I said this in a big room full of people and heard someone gasp because there is no Carolyn Keene, at least not one that actually wrote any of the Nancy Drew mysteries.
There were a series of people who wrote them, wasn't there?
Yes, you bet. So these were farmed out, you know, just like the Hardy Boys. These were series that were cooked up by a publisher in Newark, New Jersey. First, Mr. Stratemeyer, and then later his daughter, Harriet, would come up with an outline of the story. They came up with the idea of Nancy Drew, an outline of the story, and then they'd farm it out. So it's really amazing. So, you know, the one that is a garden mystery is called Password to Larkspur Lane. And it was written by a gentleman named Walter Carrig as Carolyn Keene. Walter, better known for the series Victory at Sea. He was the screenwriter. So a very unlikely Carolyn Keene, but there you go.
Was he a flower gardener? Because the book is partly about flower gardening, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. The picture I have of him, he's sitting at his typewriter with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and a little Siamese kitten on his shoulder.
Oh, man. Well, we've already mentioned Miss Marple, Agatha Christie's Miss Marple. Tell us how her Miss Marple's horticultural skills play into the plots of the story she's in.
Oh, lots of different ways. So Miss Marple lives in this fictional village, kind of like Three Pines, right? So maybe St. Mary Mead was the prototype for Louise Penny's Three Pines. And in the very first novel, she says, you know, bird watching and gardening, they're great because, you know, you're outside and you can keep an eye on your neighbors and what they're doing. So we get the feeling Miss Marple might be considered the village busybody, but she's certainly very alert to what's going on. And Agatha Christie wrote about her for decades, for something like 5 decades. And so gardening plays in terms of, you know, sometimes it'll be key to the plot. You know, sometimes she'll be sharing flowers or, you know, she'll notice that, you know, a stone is out of place and that was something in her Japanese garden. So, you know, it's just always fascinating to me to kind of track that.
Oh, boy. And Hercule Poirot was not, I mean, she wrote 22 books featuring him. He wasn't really a gardener, but there were books where he used some sort of gardening principle to solve. Did he not?
Yeah, the main one that comes to mind is called Halloween Party. And it's actually the book that was the basis for the latest movie that Kenneth Branagh was in called A Haunting in Venice. But in the book, it's not set in Venice at all. It's set in an English garden, and it's got a rock garden that plays into the plot very closely. And Christie also describes a garden that is actually an actual garden in Ireland called Ilnacullen. So she has Hercule Poirot describe this, and although he doesn't name it, it's clear that that's the garden that she's talking about, or he's talking about. And it turns out that she had visited that garden in Ireland before she wrote the book.
And roses play a role in many, many books of mysteries, do they not? I think you had as an aside that the rose was the first plant patent was for a rose.
That's true. And the first gardening detective, at least in the English language that I could find, was named Sergeant Cuff, and he was in The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, and he loved roses, so absolutely adored them.
And is thinking about other flowers, Nero Wolfe, Rex Stout, the author, Nero Wolfe led a gardening lifestyle. Explain what, you know, appears in those books relating to orchids, because it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, so if you're an orchid fancier at all, you should try out the Nero Wolfe series. It's a really engaging series. You know, it might not have all 21st century values. It doesn't always have great values related to women, as I recall. But if you can put that aside, they're good reads, and the orchid information is quite accurate because Rex Stout was quite a gardener himself, although not particularly orchids. He especially liked tall bearded irises and daylilies. But there are something like 400 named varieties of orchids in the Nero Wolfe, you know, the canon, if you will.
And he supposedly had a what do I call it now? I'm blanking on the name, but on the top of his roof, he grew orchids.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Nero Wolfe was an eccentric, and he owned this brownstone in New York City, and, you know, all fictional. And on the top floor, you know, instead of the penthouse, he had a whole series of orchid greenhouses. So you can imagine them, you know, open to the light.
And I think, as you mentioned, he took one case. He always got a lot of money for the cases he took, but he took one case because he was offered three black orchids.
Yes. And so, and that one's easy to find because the book is called Black Orchids. And, you know, you have to realize that at the time these were being written, that orchids were quite expensive. You know, you weren't buying them at your local big box store or, you know, your local supermarket. They were really a, you know, more a rich person's hobby at the time.
Marta McDowell, our guest today, her book, Gardening Can Be Murder. And if you've got a suggestion or maybe a question about a book relating to a mystery relating to gardens, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or send some email. We've got some good emails here at talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You have another section called, as you mentioned earlier, Means, Dial M for Mulch, I think is the subtitle of that time. And you know, there is pretty much... there's all kinds of things you can use to murder people when you're thinking about gardens.
Well, you know, I was out in my garden this morning. I think here in New Jersey, it's probably around the same temperature you have in Wisconsin. It's hovering just below freezing, but the sun's out. And I always feel like, I can, as long as the sun's out, I can get out and do a little bit of garden work. So I was cutting back some plants, you know, with my really sharp hedge shears. You know, I take him to the hardware store and he really sharpens up the blade and you go, yeah, you could kill somebody with this.
So you've got shears, you've got a hose would work pretty well. And then you've got the whole string of chemicals that might come into play. And then there's the plants themselves.
Yes. Yeah, my spouse started worrying while I was writing this book. Especially somebody gave me a dish towel that said, be nice to me or I'll poison your food.
Yeah, I'd be suspicious, you know, if the husband starts looking into poisonous plants and their application.
Yes, you bet. So, you know, it was really interesting because I started down this road and, you know, so now I'm going to write this chapter about plant poisons. And I realized, well, you know, I'm not a chemist. I'm a gardener, you know, it's like, and, you know, while I know some of this, I thought I'm going to get in hot water. I know I'll make some scientific mistake, but luckily my cousin is a plant toxicologist at the University of Illinois. So he read my chapter for me to make sure I wasn't going astray.
Tom in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I guess I have something of a real-life non-mystery that's related to this topic. And I may not have all of the facts of this precisely, but certainly people can look it up. But the gist of it is that Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin through from a bread mold and noticed, you know, there's no other things growing here. And then he worked with that mold to develop penicillin. But I believe the first administration of penicillin was for a police officer in Britain who had unfortunately pricked a finger on a rose thorn in undoubtedly some nice English garden. And, you know, eventually he did succumb. But My recollection of that is that this was the first use of penicillin.
Interesting story.
That is very interesting. I know whenever I prune my roses, you know, and I invariably will get scratched, right, with one of those prickles, and it'll often get a kind of little infection. So I'll have to look into that. I don't know, like, what is the toxin that hits you, but that is, you know, life before penicillin, it was very scary to get any kind of a wound.
You know, it reminds me that that's kind of a nice little aside. And one of the things I enjoyed about your book were the asides. As I mentioned earlier about the Nancy Drew Mysteries authors.
Well, as you can tell, Larry, I'm kind of interested in everything, which is, it's both a, I suppose, a positive and a negative, because I do tend to go down these paths and then find myself like way down in a rabbit hole and go, oh.
How do I get out of this? Just like a mystery writer would. Sometimes happen to them, him or her. Oh, man. Carol in Molina, Iowa. It's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I read The Orchid Thief some years ago, and I really liked it. But I don't remember the author, and someone said they made a movie of it.
Yeah.
Yes, The Orchid Thief was Susan. I seem to be good at
Orlean.
Orleans, thank you. And the movie was called Adaptation, which was a very strange movie that kind of pulled in the story, but surrounded it with this bizarre plot about a screenwriter who was trying to adapt it. And so it's a movie that I'd recommend, but it's not a standard, you know, just straight adaptation of the book. And The Orchid Thief, you know, is not fiction, you know, it's nonfiction. So again, a little different from what I was doing, because I was concentrating on crime fiction, but it's a wonderful read.
Carol, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Marta McDowell, our guest today, her book, Gardening Can Be Murder. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at the book, Gardening Can Be Murder, How Poisonous Poppies, Sinister Shovels, and Grim Gardens Have Inspired Mystery Writers. Marta McDowell, the author, with us today. You have a suggestion or a question, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. Peg in Dodgeville emailed and says, you need to mention Ellis Peters' Brother Cadfael series. He's the consummate monk gardener, and several of the books do revolve around plants as the murder weapon, monk's hood, for example, or give a big clue. Marta, what do you think?
Absolutely. I love the Brother Cadfael series, the Cadfael Chronicles, I think, sort of, they're known as. It's 21 books. The author wrote them in about a decade. So she was putting out more than a book a year.
Wow.
Alice Peters is the author, but that was a pen name for a woman named Edith Pargeter. She was from the city of Shrewsbury in the west of England, very close to Wales. And she was an amateur historian, but they're very well researched and they're set in the 12th century. So, you know, think of these. They start coming out in the 1970s. She really pegs the subgenre that we now think of as, you know, a historical crime. So she's writing about a 12th century monk who's the herbalist for the monastery. So he has the herb garden, as they'd say in England, the herb garden, as we'd say here. And, you know, as your listener mentioned, they're wonderful reads. And they were also a really great series very mm-hmm. early on mystery with Derek Jacobi. And so if you get a chance, you can also look up those. They're probably on YouTube or from your public library.
Yeah, that was a PBS series, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, back in the day, you know, it's back when like Gene Shalit was the host.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I wanted to bring up, we haven't mentioned Sherlock Holmes at all, and I wanted to bring up a little aside that you, another one of those, you got off, well, not off on a tangent, but just a nugget of information that I didn't know, that Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote, of course, the Sherlock Holmes mystery series, when he was studying medicine, you said, he had to take a botany course for his medical degree.
Yeah, so, you know, realize that until fairly recently, you know, certainly all through the 19th century and into the early 20th century, every medical doctor was taking a botany course because most of the medicines were plant-based. You know, they weren't synthetic medicines at that point. So Conan Doyle is studying to be a doctor. He's in Edinburgh, and he's taking this botany course at the Botanical Garden, which is very famous. And I guess they're talking about different possible uses of plants, and he decides he's going to, like, experiment on himself with a treatment for the eye, which is from a yellow flowering vine called gelseminum. Sometimes they'll call it yellow jasmine, but it's poisonous, and he's administering it to himself
in different doses. As if I'm trying to remember, yeah. He would get stronger and stronger to see how much he could do before he went blind or it killed him.
Yeah, so this is like a sample size of one. Probably not a good idea. So we're glad he survived that, or he never would have had all of the wonderful Sherlock Holmes adventures.
Oh, man. I wanted to bring up another little aside. There's a section called Clues, Green Evidence, or Red Herrings. And I think you get off into... where the term red herring came from.
Yeah, herrings evidently were used in the training of foxhounds. And red herrings in particular was some kind of smoking process that would make the herrings turn red. But, you know, they try to make sure that the up-and-coming hounds were not distracted by other scents. So one scent they try would be this herring, which would be a very strong smell, as is fox, I suppose.
that was another little interesting aside. The caretaker gardener, tell us about The Crocodile Bird by Ruth Rendell.
Yeah, that is Ruth Rendell was, I'm not sure she's with us anymore, but terrific writer, really, you know, highly awarded and very good reads. Both her short stories are very gripping. And this was a novel. One of the main characters is a caretaker at an estate that, you know, includes a lot of gardening. And just a wonderful, gripping read right to the end. Probably not the kind you want to read right before you go to bed.
And plants can be forensic evidence, of course. And one of the books you cited was a Tony Hillerman book. The Wailing Wind. And how plant materials help catch the killer.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is factually true. There are people who are forensic botanists, and they use plant material, you know, right down to pollen, you know, kind of microscopic things that found on clothing to try to figure out where a murder actually occurred, or, you know, was a body moved, or, you know, was this suspect, you know, involved in some way. And so Hillerman used it very cleverly in that, with these thorny seed pods that were attached to somebody's boot, you know, to say, well, this is not something that occurred in the area where we found the body. So, you know, it must have been committed elsewhere.
Yeah, and there was just kind of like one area where those plants were. So he was able to find it all, proceed with from that. Did you make any surprising discoveries during your research for the book? Probably a lot of them, but
I think, you know, it was surprising to me how many, and, you know, they continue, and you can tell from today, you know, this is like how many books have been, you know, involved in this, again, kind of who knew subgenre. So, it, you know, it continues to be something that stimulates mystery writers, I think, because it is very rich.
Yeah. If you're thinking about the books that you've read in this area, what are your top book suggestions for someone who wants to read about gardening in mystery books?
Well, I loved the book Deacon King Kong, and that is a new book. Here we go again. I'm going to go blank on the author, James McBride. Deacon King Kong is a book that has gardeners, it has gardening, and it has particular plants. If you're looking for a dead body, that's not in there. But there is a shooting right at the start, and there is a mystery all the way through, which is, what's the motive? What caused this crime? And just so beautifully written and so cleverly done. If you want a classic murder mystery, I would suggest, I think, Death in the Garden. Again, a wonderful book by Elizabeth Ironside. It's an English murder mystery. It takes place in sort of a then and now, so there are flashbacks. Really wonderful. And, you know, we've talked about many of them today. I love Christie, you know, I love Ellis Peters. I love them so many. There are just so many. And, you know, it's why I've assembled a list that keeps on growing.
Well, it was certainly a lot of fun to read your book. I hope it's doing well.
I think so. My publisher said they'd do another one with me. So.
Oh, all right. So it's doing well. Marta, I can tell you it's been an absolute joy talking with you today. Thank you so much. For being with us today and for writing the book. Appreciate it very much.
And thank you. Bye-bye.
Marta McDowell, her latest book is Gardening Can Be Murder, How Poisonous Poppies, Sinister Shovels, and Grim Gardens Have Inspired Mystery Writers. Really a lot of fun to read. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And today we start the show by talking about perennials, which I think are the backbone of many a garden here in our state. The American Horticultural Society has a new book out. It's called Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. And here to tell us about it, Matt Mattis. He is an American Horticultural Society member. He's an author and horticulturist, and really great to have him with us today. And want to hear from you. What questions do you have about your perennials? Are you looking maybe for a low-maintenance perennial for your garden? What other questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Matt Mattis, welcome. Tell us about the American Horticultural Society. What's your mission?
Sure. Thank you, Larry. I'm excited to be here. Well, I am the Senior Director of Horticulture at the American Horticultural Society, which I think which is really, you know, experiencing a resurgence now in popularity. There's so many plant societies across the country, but they have one that's national and one that's from, let's say, the early 20th century, from, you know, 1920 or so. It's just a great organization. It has a great publication. We have a bi-monthly magazine, which I think a lot of people don't know about. But it's if you're a plant geek or a plant nerd or a vegetable gardener or a perennial gardener, I think you'd find it eye-opening. So, we hit every state in the country.
And you have a really cool farm. It's called River Farm as your headquarters. Tell us about River Farm. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, that was actually part of George Washington's original property on the Delaware. So a very historic site. It's open to the public. It's also a botanic garden and a great old farmhouse there. And, you know, people have their weddings there. It's, you know, what you would do at a normal botanic garden. But also it houses the American Horticultural Society.
Yeah. I know the AHS, American Horticultural Society, offers a number of educational opportunities. Maybe you could talk about the kinds of educational opportunities you offer.
Oh, sure. Well, we have people who, no matter where you live in the country, right, you can participate in things like, we have AHS Explore, which is a fantastic travel program. Traveling, you know, this year we're going to Japan, we're going to Ireland next year, to the Netherlands. It's a lot of people take advantage of that. And there's different levels of tours, even in the country, like Santa Fe. So if you love gardens and you want, you know, art and culture mixed in, those are great trips. We have something called the AHS Garden Network, which is really a fantastic deal where you get discounts at all of the partner botanic gardens around the country. So from in New England here, the New England Botanic Garden or the New York Botanic Garden or on the West Coast, you don't have to pay full admission. Sometimes it's free admission, and there are other benefits that come with that. So that's a big one that members enjoy. And then there's AHS Live, which is, you know, where no matter where you are, if you have a computer and you can take classes, online learning series, and all different levels from beginners to experts. And those are really focused, you know, some have been like on pollinator gardens with Kelly Norris or planting vegetable gardens. It's, I think people really enjoy that. So you can see it's truly a national organization. And I think the best benefit is the American Gardener magazine, which is an award-winning magazine. And you only get it if you're a member, so it's really worth it. It's really one of America's premier gardening magazines and worth checking out.
The book, I mean, AHS has published a number of gardening books, and the one we'll kind of focus on today is titled Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. What makes a good gardening reference book in your mind?
I think a good gardening book would, you know, provide information for a gardener as he or she grows, right? So some of us are beginners, some of us are experts. I think you can learn something from any book, but I, you know, particularly with me, I like to have a book that I'm always learning something with. And this one does that. I mean, I wrote a book on flower gardening, right? But the information that's in this is it covers a little bit of everything. So whereas, let's say, my book doesn't cover design of a garden, for instance, or how do you work with the soil. So if you're brand new to perennial gardening, this book is helpful. If you're an expert, it covers sort of new trends in perennial gardening.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book, and I love the photos you do and the diagrams. You do such an the book does such a nice job of explaining things, and then we get to see the flowers, the perennials, and we get to see how they're located in a landscape for really good ideas, you know, for your own landscape.
Yeah, no matter where you live, I think a lot of the older perennial books tended to focus, let's say, on an English approach, like an English border. And you know, perennials became very popular again in the 1980s. So a lot of Americans with backyards or front yards wanted to have that English border or that cottage garden. But in our modern life, things have changed. We don't have gardeners. We don't have time to spend, you know, with a 15-foot deep border. This book covers all sorts of perennials. So if you have a shady yard, if you have a woodland garden, that's where perennials live. If you have a full sunny farm border, you know, and you want pollinators in it, this book goes into that sort of detail. I don't know many new perennial books that cover these new trends, like I want a pollinator, or I want to plant a border with natives, or maybe I want some natives, some grasses, some pollinator plants, and some old-fashioned, you know, cottage perennials all together. So, we, you know, we've changed how we garden, and this book addresses that.
It does indeed. Martha in Menominee, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Larry. I'm so excited. Here's my plan. I want to grow lupine. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I saw it growing up in northern Wisconsin, near a riverbed. I don't have a riverbed in my yard, but I do have a low wet spot. Can I grow lupine in my yard?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Martha. I love lupins. Lupins or lupine, there's no wrong way to say it because botanical Latin was not a spoken language. But I think you're one of the best parts of the country to be able to grow lupins, because of, you know, the cooler summers than, let's say, we would have, you know, in the south or in the sub-Atlantic area. So, yes, you should be able to grow them. I mean, how wet does it get?
Well, I just have some low spots in my yard that typically are soppy, you know, and it takes a few days longer to dry up. They do get full sun, you know, it does get full sun there. So I'm thinking it's worth a try. What do you think?
I think so. They enjoy moisture. They don't want to be soaking wet, but if, as long as it drains, it's still damp. The lupins do not want to dry out, so I would think that's probably a good condition to try them. And full sun definitely will help.
Yeah. Martha, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. For new gardeners, explain what a perennial is.
Oh, sure. So a perennial is any plant that's an herbaceous plant. So an herbaceous plant is a plant that, say, emerges from the ground, that grows up in the spring and summer, and then in the autumn it dies back to the ground again, mostly right to the ground again. And you may see dead stalks or seed pods. And then reemerges again the following year. And most perennials can be, you know, obviously the word perennial comes back every year, whereas, let's say, a biennial, which is a little more confusing of a term, would be a plant that maybe has to grow for a whole year or two and then bloom, and then it completes its life and sets seed again, like foxgloves, for instance, or hollyhocks. But a perennial would come back every year. There are things that are not to be too confusing, but there are things that are called short-lived perennials. And lupins, what we just talked about, would be one of those, where a lupin, especially a hybrid, like a Russell hybrid, may come back for two or three years, or a columbine, and then start to fade away and get a little weaker, and often they self-seed and will come up somewhere else. So they last more than 2 years. But snapdragons actually could be a mild, sort of short-lived perennial in warmer climates. But generally, it's a plant that comes back. But there are very long-lived perennials, like peonies, that could last 100 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And the new book, I really like this one feature of the book. It features 150 plant profiles and with some great photos. How did you decide on those 150?
I know, it's a bit of a beauty contest, right? Oh, well, so what's interesting about these plant profiles, because yes, you do want to include something that everyone will like, but instead of including all the common perennials, we try to include perennials that, you know, are new in the trade or new to even conventional perennial growers. You know, something like Amazonia, which is a native subshrub or a native perennial that you'll see, you know, planted in these meadow plantings that are so popular now. A lot of those plants are added in here. So a lot of these sort of naturalizing plants, so people who plant matrices of plants, so every foot, you know, 1 foot apart on a grid of grasses and then interplanted with bulbs and interplanted with another perennial, those types of perennials made it in here. So we try not to include the real common ones that you know, but also some of the ones that people, you know, maybe have trouble growing, like hollyhocks, or newer ones in the trade, like alstroemeria. Some of the new hybrids like Allium Millennium, like these have different uses in the garden now. And these plants were not available 7-10 years ago.
Yeah, it's great. And the other thing I really liked about those profiles is that, all right, in this little block, for you've got a photo of the perennial, but then you have a lot of really useful information, shorthand information, about the conditions, sun amount, the heat tolerances.
Yeah, pruning. I mean, we've included some, you know, what people think of as rhizomes or bulbs, like, you know, bearded iris or cannas even. People often are confused. What do I do with them in the fall? Can I cut them back? Are they hardy in zone 7, which they are, but in zone 6, they're not. So do I dig them up or not?
It's
like a baseball card.
Yeah, it's like a baseball. You're right. It's like a baseball
right?
card, but gives you a lot of really good information packed in each one of those cards that makes for a very quick reference. I really like that.
Oh, good. Yeah, it gives you the stats, so you get the basics.
Matt Natt is our guest today. He is an American Horticultural Society member, horticulturist, and author, and we're talking with him about perennials today on the show. You can join in with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Matt Mattis, American Horticultural Society member, horticulturist and author, and the book we're talking about is the AHS book, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening. And so talking perennials with him, and you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Lucy in Waupaca. Lucy, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a swamp mallow hibiscus. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, I want to propagate it, and I don't know if I should propagate it from seed or...
Oh, we lost Lucy.
Oh,
how does she propagate it? Does she do it from seed or cuttings?
From seed. Yeah, absolutely from seed. So a swamp mallow, I mean, you would want to, so it's a hibiscus. I mean, it's actually the hibiscus, I believe, that they made marshmallow from, that sort of mucilage that was in the liquid in the stems back in the old days. But it's definitely from seed, like most mallows. And so that's in the hibiscus family. So a Malvaceae would be the hibiscus family. But definitely the seeds, which you would have to stratify for maybe, which means provide them sort of a cold. You could do it in the refrigerator. I probably wouldn't freeze them, even though in the wild they freeze. I think a damp cold, like wrap the seed up in a damp paper towel, put it in a poly bag, put it in your refrigerator for maybe 4 to 6 weeks, and then sow the seeds. You can sow the seeds under lights. And so you could do it a bit early, let's say in March. So maybe the timing is right. So you still have time to chill them and to start them and keep them under lights, of course, until after any threat of frost, and then transplant them out into the garden.
And one of the features of this book, by the way, is propagation. And I know you have some good photos and some good information on plant propagation.
Yeah, there's a whole section on plant propagation. And, you know, propagation could be something as simple as digging up, let's say, a perennial that grew too old in the garden. After 5 or 6 years, they form like a shape like a tire in the ground, so they're dead in the center, and it's a ring. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes.
In your garden, right? So, it, you know, from that, let's say it's an aster or even a daylily, you can get, you know, 6 plants, maybe even more. And certainly with hostas and things like that, a heuchera. But that's the easiest way. But then also we go into root cuttings, stem cuttings. We mentioned earlier, we talked about the lupin. That's something in, you know, the old timers used to cut the roots and root and pot the roots up horizontally in a seed tray, and the root cuttings would grow, or stem cuttings in March, which is how you would propagate delphiniums, for instance.
We get a lot of questions over time about plant propagation, and that's why I thought, this is a valuable source of information in this book, for sure. Lucy, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Gianni in Montello next. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good morning, Matt and Larry. Thank you for taking my call. My question regards lingonberries. I spent some time in central Sweden, and we, in the summertime, we picked lingonberries in the forest. My question is, are they native to the New World, or were they introduced here? And why aren't they cultivated here like the cranberry? Because they are absolutely delicious, but very, very dear when you buy them.
They are. I agree. I live in a Swedish neighborhood, so in Massachusetts. So I'm familiar with lingonberries. And it's funny you ask this, because I agree with you. I have never seen them offered here or grown here, but they can be, and certainly where you are and where I live in the country. I know they're available now online. You can Google. There's one retailer that sells them, and I'm going to be trying them this year, so I can't speak to how successful they are. But I know that they're sort of a high-acid soil plant like blueberries. It's certainly something worth trying. I can't speak to how well they'll grow, but it seems like they were grown, I know, back in the colonial times. So, and especially through like Nova Scotia, Canada.
Yeah, the soil type is kind of the problem, and people certainly grow lingonberries in Wisconsin, but to make that soil, our basic soil, acidic enough, it requires what should I say, fairly constant attention to the soil.
Yeah, but I know people who grow them in pots, so
yeah.
It's probably easier to keep.
Yes.
You know, you probably would have to go peat based, which we're all trying to use less peat these days. But it's probably easier to keep the soil. It's certainly not the temperature, because they're zone 2 plants. You know, so they probably grow better in northern Canada.
Yeah.
Or Sweden.
And the soil type's a little better there too, I think, for them as well. Johnny, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dave and Toma, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Well, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. Blueberries and mulberries. Number one, are mulberries, I've never had one. Are they worth eating? Are they good?
I'm sure there's a mulberry council, but I would say they're not that sweet. I mean, they're ornamental cultivars that have, you know, weeping foliage. You often see these in cemeteries, or, you know, it's like a weeping willow form, or fancy leaves on them. But there are cultivars that have very large fruit. But I would say there's probably a reason you don't see mulberry jam sold. at the supermarket, right? But they certainly have their fans. I know they're very popular in Asia, and there are cultivars, which I have not tasted, but that are grown commercially.
Yeah.
I think it's a short-lived plant, and they can be messy. The fruit drops.
Yes, it does. Thank you, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. And then you have to keep the birds away.
No, well, that's part of the messy part, right? I mean, Don't park under them.
Lynn in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. This might be a little bit dumb, but can you put weed and seed on your flower beds? I know there's preen, but what about the regular, you know, you buy a big bag for your yard. Can you put that on your flower beds?
I would say just do it carefully. There are plants. Listen, there are plant people. Let's say really plant geeks who grow alpine plants in, you know, a gravel elevated bed, and they actually use a weed and feed because it doesn't seem to harm some alpine plants. But you need to know what genus you have with species, and are they sensitive to it? Because obviously, it can kill a weed, so you can certainly, you know, kill half of or everything you have at the same time. Yeah. Probably experimented on something first.
Yeah, we could turn to a minute to your section on nutrients and soil chemistry, which I found really interesting. You even had five myths about plant nutrients and soil chemistry that I thought were kind of fun and interesting as well.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Of course, you know, in our modern world, we're more educated, we're more sensitive to what we put in our soil, on our soil, the health of our soil, the microorganisms. And I think, you know, any serious gardener would say, don't use a weed and feed. But I do know people that use it, say, on a lawn or in a garden, maybe where you're growing a monoculture or one plant that you know is sensitive to it. I mean, environmentally, it's probably not wise. But, I mean, that's a decision that's up to you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the myths you had, organic is always safe.
Oh, right. I mean, I think chemicals are chemicals, and this comes up all the time. Amongst plant people, and you know, what's a good source of nitrogen? And you know, we may have one that, you know, comes from the oil industry, but also, will a plant know the difference between the chemicals? So the chemistry obviously factors in. I guess the best bit of advice is just to educate yourself as much as possible to what you're putting on an organic insecticide or herbicide can be just as dangerous. Vinegar in many ways is more dangerous to your soil than, you know, another chemical source, but it's an acid. It's still a chemical. So be careful.
Diana in Gladstone, Michigan. It's your turn. Hi.
Okay. Larry and guest. Hello. So we moved into a new house last year, and I have two gardens, and one is completely shady and the other one is partially sunny, but you know, like half is sunny, so half the side grows good, but the other half doesn't. Of course, I wasn't thinking when I put it in. So I'm just wondering, two questions. Anything flowering that I could actually put in a more shady area and that the deer won't eat?
Well, that's a good, you know, good thing I'm glad you brought up deer, because this book is I'm impressed with how many of these plants that are in here that the deer will not eat. Or there's no plant a deer won't eat, but let's say deer resistant. Either might be because the leaves are furry or they're prickly or the plant doesn't taste good. But on the shady side, there are certainly things like Alchemilla mollis, that's a lady's mantle that has beautiful lime green flowers and foamy airiness. And you could have campanulas coming out of that. I personally have a mostly shady garden, so I know there are a lot of things. Podophyllum, things that have interesting foliage do well. Karenge shoma, I think we overlook those plants that bloom in September, October. Karenge shoma from Korea has beautiful golden waxy bells. there are plenty of plants in here that you could grow in shade. Columbine, certainly.
There are a number of them, but it's a question that we often get, Matt. People would love to have flowers, you know, blooming in shade.
Yeah. Well, you know, an easy way around that is go to your local garden center, but just don't go in May. Go through the summer months and go into late summer, autumn. An astilbe may not be blooming until June or July, and so many of us just go to the garden center in May and June, and that's it. So you'll see what's in bloom, and then you can choose the colors you want. And especially getting later into summer, that's when I think a lot of shade gardens tend to go. Either the ephemerals go away and you're left with not much, or just grasses or hosta. But you certainly can find more interesting plants to be added in late summer, fall, too.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip, for sure. Diana, thanks again for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Get you on pretty quickly. Nancy in Wautoma emailed to ask what perennials to plant on top of a septic drain field. She would love to restore a lawn area with prairie plants, and she appreciates deep-rooted perennials impacting, or she's apprehensive about deep-rooted perennials impacting the drain field.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have experience planting on a drain field, but I have planted on them things like peonies. Or is it full sun?
I don't know.
Yes, no. Yeah. So, it's probably better than lawn. I mean, your grass is usually greener there, right?
Yeah.
high nitrogen. I don't know. I think you'd have to. I would think there's more plants that grow there than don't. If it's an active drain field, too, I'm not sure how deep, when she is talking about deep-rooted perennials.
And she was a little worried about them having some impact on the drain field. I would suggest, and I know for sure, for example, that Prairie Nursery in Plainfield, Wisconsin, has a list of plants, of prairie plants that can grow on a drain field. And that person might just check Prairie Nursery or some of the other native plant nurseries that are in the state and take a look at their website, because I know they do offer some possibilities. So certainly worth a look. Miranda emailed to ask what seeds should be winter sowed for perennials. She wants to use milk jugs and a water bottle method, and did start a few already, including hollyhock, lupin, and poppies. Are there others she should and could still put out, or is it better to start inside now?
Yes, that's a really good question. I mean, personally, I don't support the milk jug method at all. You probably would only limit that to seedlings that don't mind being transplanted, things like poppies or even lupins when they get larger, or milkweed, don't want their roots disturbed at all. So unless you put three seeds in a jug that are 2 inches, 3 inches apart, and you can carefully separate them, I would never tear. Mm-hmm. I've seen this, you know, often suggested on social media, you know, tear the root ball off. But cold seed starting outdoors certainly is one method. Mine sit in you know, 2 or 3 inch pots right now with gravel on top, outside in the snow, no covering. So the idea of making a mini greenhouse, which is the method of taking a milk jug, heats it up too warm on a sunny day, especially in February and March. Then it gets down cold again at night, is not helping those plants at all. They're much better if they germinate naturally, let's say in mid-April, early May, for pots that have been outside all winter, for those that require it. You would have to look online and see which, but I see a lot of suggestions, again, on social media, of plants that really don't need to be started in, especially poppies, for instance, which do not need cold stratification at all. the fact that they can survive in the cold is, I think, confuses people. Oh. You know, there's no need to sow on snow. There's no they germinate at 80 degrees, 90 degrees, or that first warm spring day. So you're better off sowing those maybe later in spring than in the winter.
Yeah, and it reminds me about climate. We have a rapidly changing climate. How much should we consider that when selecting perennials?
Well, I mean, I suppose there's good news there that we can start trying some different warmer ones that are better in warmer climates or zones. But, you know, at least here in New England, we get unpredictable springs. I don't know what you have there, but
yes.
Perennials that emerge too quickly, let's say, in spring, because let's say we had a warm winter and they started mm-hmm. growing, and then we, you know, we have a cold spell and it's 10 degrees, it's 5 degrees for 3 days, and that new growth is damaged. Mm-hmm. That happens more often now than it ever has before. So we're all trying to navigate those waters now.
Yeah, for sure. Gail is on the road to Madison and couldn't stay with us, but wondering if Milorganite is good to work into the soil of her perennial beds in the spring.
Oh, that's a great question. I can't answer it. I've never used it.
Yeah,
it's like a high nitrogen feed, right? Or at least, you know, it's more like fish fertilizer in a way, I think, in its formula. So it's, just looking at the analysis of it, I would put it on snow or earlier in the year before plants are emerging.
Merritt in Wausau emailed to say they aren't flowering, but ferns are very deer resistant, and there are so many beautiful types of ferns available.
That's a good point. Yeah, and I love ferns. We keep adding more and more to our garden, and they just look great, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt Mattis, our guest today, I should mention, coming up in the second hour of the show, we'll be taking a look at buying and caring for houseplants with the owner of the Madison Greenhouse Store, Tiffany Olson. So that's later on. Right now, though, we're looking at perennials with Matt. And you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, right now visiting about perennials. And Judy in Madison has a question for you, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, Judy.
I had a pot of calla lilies last fall, and as they faded and died, I saved the seeds. So what do you recommend now for doing with those seeds in order to maybe get them to grow?
Okay.
All right. So, Zilly, you had seeds or are the bulbs in the pot?
No, the seeds that were at the blossoms.
Oh, okay. So those you can sow right away. Hopefully they're still, I'm not sure if they'll still be vital or not, but they're really a berry. It's an aroid, so they're more like berry-like. But I would try sowing now. I have not grown them from seed. I've only divided the bulbs. Do you still have the pot?
Yes, I do.
So I would dig down into the pot and see if there's, you know, a bulb still down in there. And that's sort of your backup plan.
Okay.
Start watering that and see how that grows.
Okay. There you go, Judy. Thank you for calling. Jen in Ashland will go to you now. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to comment. The gentleman that called earlier about lingonberries, I live up near Ashland, and I grow them in a raised bed. I have a lot of pine trees, so my native soil is really acidic. So I use the soil from my yard in the raised bed. And I have about 8 plants. They're very small, and they do really well. They don't produce a ton of berries, but we get enough for a few handfuls, and we stew them and put them on pancakes or crepes or what have you. So they're pretty easy to grow, and I would totally encourage him to give it a try.
right.
That's great.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Jen. And Matt, I should tell you that we have a pretty broad audience here, and the audience consists of everything from first-time gardeners to folks who have completed the many iterations of the Master Gardener program. So oftentimes, yeah, oftentimes if somebody asks a question, somebody will pipe up with their experience, which is always good to have. Thanks again, Jen. Karen in St. Croix Falls will go to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Happy Valentine's Day.
To you as well.
I bought a new house, and I am an avid gardener, but I've always wanted a perennial garden. And what is the number one tip you can give me for starting out? I'm thinking you're going to say the soil, but I'm all ears.
I am going to say the soil. Well, this how if your new house is a new construction?
Yes, and I'm going to be landscaping.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's nothing you can't overcome. The problem with new construction homes is often the ground is too, the soil's too compacted. When we built our greenhouse here, we had tractors come in and ran over, you know, 150-year-old garden. And then it took 10 years for the garden to come back to normal because the soil is compacted. But so you'll probably have to condition your soil a bit, you know, add some conditioner in. I'm not sure what your soil's like, but you should know as an experienced gardener once you turn it over. If it's too disturbed or it's, you know, maybe they brought soil in, you may have to enhance the soil. But you absolutely would. This is the time to start a perennial garden.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen, good luck with it. Thank you very much for calling. That compacted soil would be a...
Yeah, organic matter, get a lot in there. Compost, if you can even order it from a place or even turning in, you know, composted wood bark. Order a big load of mulch and let it sit for a year or two and then add that in too.
Yeah. Good points. Karen, good luck. Thank you. Joel in Green Bay up next. Hi, Joel.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm new to gardening in the house, and I was wondering if I would be able to grow some perennials in the house. I have a few plants already, and they're doing really good. I have a south-facing window, which is the only window that faces south, so I'm limited to that. I was wondering if I could grow perennials in the house.
That's an interesting question, a popular thing to do in the 19th century, especially in colder climates, where people would dig, you know, astilbes, for instance, were often sold as an Easter plant or even at Valentine's Day forced. So, I mean, obviously, if they're outdoor plants, they need a dormant and cool period to rest. You know, maybe you have a garage, you have some place outside where they can go for a bit, but bring them back indoors. I mean, technically, most houseplants are perennials, you know, but they're tropical. But it's going to take some experimentation, but I know that Tova Martin, the writer, is working on an article for us for a future issue on growing perennials in the house. I think it's more about forcing perennials in, so you have a cool bedroom or unheated room that you can bring them in. But I say go for it. You're going to have to learn on the way with this one because I don't think there's a lot of information out there if they're garden perennials, but if they're growing for you, go for it.
And we'll be talking about houseplants coming up in our next segment, and I can raise that issue with our guest at that time as well, who works a lot with houseplants. Joel, so thank you for calling. Carmen in Sturgeon Bay will turn to you next. Hi, Carmen.
Oh, good morning. I'm calling because I have a prickly pear cactus in a flower garden that I need to move this spring. And I'm looking for some recommendations on transplanting a prickly pear cactus.
And gloves.
Yeah, gloves.
Yeah. Well, I would try and move it early before the new pads come out. And, you know, some of the tricks that people have is they use rolled up newspaper. I mean, if they still have newspapers and kind of wrap and use that to pick the plant up with. But if you're doing it with a shovel, do it before the new growth because those new pads can be very limp. You don't want them to limp and not be turgid full of water. Or wait until they've matured, let's say in July or late June, and move it then.
All right, Carmen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed back to mulberries for a minute. She has a mulberry tree and harvests and freezes as much as she can. She thinks they're a superfood. She eats them on her cereal every day. They don't have much taste, but if they're an easy and free superfood, that's fine with her. Biggest benefit with mulberries, it attract lots of birds. The most entertaining guests are the cedar waxwings, of course. They eat the overripe berries and, well, get drunk and fly around intoxicated. Truly a hoot.
That's great. Oh, well, they are a superfood. They're high in vitamin C, that's for sure. The birds know that.
Phil in Mount Horeb, we'll go to you. Hi, Phil.
I'd love to know what that proper dimension is for cold or duration for setting seeds that need that cold period.
That's a really good question. There's a lot of confusion about this and a lot of misinformation. I'm going to give you a book to go look for online. It's a free PDF you can download. It's at a lot of rock garden sites. It's called Seed Germination Theory and Practice, and it's by Dr. Norman Deno, D-E-N-O. And it's like a 300-page photocopied book that's been passed around, you know, plant collectors for, you know, 15, 20 years now. But it will tell you what seeds need to be stratified for how long and which ones don't. Like, you know, Rudbeckia, I mean, a lot of people are sowing those in jugs. They don't need to be chilled. Or foxgloves or, as I said earlier, poppies. In fact, all the annual poppies do not need to be cold. They all germinate above 70, ideally closer to 90. So that's, you need to, it really depends on every plant.
And
but, even like cardinal flower doesn't need to be chilled at all.
So I'm sure there are people saying, wait a minute, what was the title of that free book?
Yeah, it's called, Say It Slowly, Seed Germination Theory and Practice. It's a bit of a science-y book, but there's a lot of information in there. I think there's probably over 1,000 plants listed. And the author's name is Norman C. Deno, D-E-N-O. He was a professor of chemistry.
Phil, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. In the book, the book, again, I'll give the title of the book we've been sort of zeroing in a bit on. It's the title is Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening. That's the main title. The subtitle, Techniques and Know-How for Planting and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. A really nice book filled with photos and written in a way that any of us can understand, which I also like a whole lot. And in the book, you talk about gardening as an ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a real trend now, and there are good reasons for it. I mean, I think we forget, right? The garden's part of our ecosystem.
Yeah, and become a kind of an ecosystem in and among themselves, in and of itself, I should say.
It is, and it's not just saying grow only natives. You know, certainly there are guides in the book where if you're interested in growing only natives, you can. But I think you know, the reality is we're mixing a little bit of everything: Asiatic plants from around the world, which is important too because diversity is important in the plant world. You know, there are trilliums here in North America, and there are even more trillium species elsewhere in the world. And maybe some of those are endangered, or mayapples in China are endangered. So we maybe should have all six species in our garden here to help keep, you know, the whole genus alive. So we, you know, we try to encourage, you know, build the garden you want, but also build it in a smart way so the ecology of that garden is good for the plants, for the wildlife, and for you.
Yeah, I was thinking about some of the perennial beds that I have. I have a perennial bed between the sidewalk and the street. So it's a fairly narrow area, but it's really pretty. throughout the summer. If I ever sell my house, I'm going to sell it in July because all of those perennials, or many of them, are in full bloom at that time.
Oh, yeah, smart.
They've been in now for quite a while, and I'm wondering about dividing. They're great because they last a long time, but in many cases, that means you need to divide at some point. How do you know when to do it?
Well, it depends on the plant, of course, but it is safe to say that not all perennials want to be divided, first of all. So, you know, something, again, like it's a lupin or a peony or something that has a brittle root or a deep root or a baptisia. I mean, good luck trying to divide that. But the ones that you will notice them slowly spreading and forming a clump, those generally are, you know, should be divided or divided, repotted, and given away to friends and family every 3 to 5 years. The plants will just be better, and you're getting a lot of free plants.
Yeah, you really are. Another question here. We've got many perennials bloom once a year. Are there ways to increase bloom time on perennials?
Not really, but there are ways to, depending on the perennial, there are ways to delay bloom or to encourage a longer season. So let's say, a phlox. If it's a tall phlox in your perennial border and you do what they call the Chelsea chop, which is you pinch out the stems in end of May or beginning of June, that could delay blooming. But a trick is to perhaps do that to only half your stems. So the first batch of will bloom in June and then into July, and the ones that you pinched will bloom a little bit later, like 3 or 4 weeks later.
That's a very, very...
A Veronica you can do that with, too.
Yeah, that's a very, very good tip. And I think for some natives, when you put the seeds in will make a difference on flowering as well. Some flower late, some flower early. And so when you put those seeds in, you need to keep that in mind as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's challenging today because you buy plants at garden centers, and a lot of these plants came from, you know, gardens further south than where you live. Around here, they come maybe from Pennsylvania, so they're two zones ahead of us in the spring, but they want to sell these plants when they're in bloom. But the following year in your own garden, they may bloom 4 weeks later than they did the year before. Yeah. So it's a little misleading. So this book, we try to put out the actual timing of these plants.
So how do people get the American Horticultural Society book, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening?
Well, the book is available, let's say, you know, wherever books are sold, but definitely on Amazon and other online book sources. It's called The Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, and you'll see right on the cover the big pink flower logo for the American Horticultural Society. There's a companion book that's called Organic Vegetable Gardening. It's the same shape and sort of same design cover, so it's a great companion to that. But they're both out now. They just were published and available across the country.
Yeah, and it's a dandy book on perennials, I'll tell you that for sure. Matt, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Hope we can do this again. Would you be willing to come back at some point?
I would love to. Thank you, Larry.
It's been a pleasure. Matt Mattis, American Horticulture Society member, horticulturist, and author, and the book we've been talking about again, Essential Guide to Perennial Gardening, subtitled Techniques and Know-How for Planning, Planting, and Tending Low-Maintenance Perennial Plantings. Take a look at it for sure. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.